You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. My name is Mike McFaul, and I'm the director here at FSI. And it is my real honor to welcome Gerhard Casper to our program today. Gerhard is an expert in constitutional law, which we're going to be speaking about. He was the dean at Chicago's law school from 1979 to 1987. In 1992, he joined Stanford as its ninth president, and then was the director here at FSI from 2012 to 2013, and now he sits down the hall from me. Maybe you have other offices on campus, Gerhard, but we're glad to have you at FSI with us. So it is a real pleasure that we can talk to you today, especially about this really old thing called the Constitution. I find in my conversation with my children, with my neighbors, with my colleagues, much greater interest these days in the Constitution. The 25th Amendment, for instance, I've heard more reference to that than ever before. Probably because of our times, and we're going to get to that, a renewed interest in the Constitution around our country. So give us that 30,000 feet just to start. How do you think our Constitution's holding up?
On the whole, I think quite well. The United States, in part because of the Constitution, has a very strong civic culture, civil society, and the civil society has certainly been very energetic. I think, for instance, the First Amendment has been energized almost just judging by the number of emails dealing with political subjects I receive every day. This is a total sea change from before. So those parts are doing, I think, quite well. The big issues that have come up under President Trump actually have a lot to do with executive power.
Right.
And to some extent, you might say that President Trump, has been trying to undo executive orders that Obama promulgated, right? So this is a very direct kind of conflict. And one of the difficulties I think we face is that over the decades, presidential power has grown and grown and grown.
Right.
And so President Obama decided to take executive action of great importance and great import, though you might indeed have questioned his power to do so.
Right.
For instance, what he did for the Dreamers. Some of his environmental regulations that arguably were not quite in accord or went way beyond the Clean Air Act. The interesting thing is the Paris Accord, the Climate Accord, which is, after all, an executive agreement. And, normally something of that importance in most countries would be viewed as a treaty and would be ratified as
a
treaty.
Go to the Senate then for us.
Right. And that, of course, would not have been possible because the Senate would never have given him the two-thirds support that he would have needed for a treaty. So he decided to use a road that, in the case of executive agreements, is kind of well-established. Say, okay, this is for the executive branch to decide as an international agreement on.
That sounds kind of unconstitutional to my ear.
Yeah, you know, Mike, I have been arguing this issue many years ago quite intensely. I think treaties have to take a greater role if we want to take seriously the role that was assigned to the Senate in the Constitution.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that I would say roughly since the 40s, 50s, executive agreements have become par for the course.
Uh-huh.
And there is less to object there, I think, in the case of President Obama, as there is with respect to environmental regulation or, in particular, the Dreamers. The Dreamers were a big issue. Now, the interesting aspect of all of this, including the Paris Accords, is that President Trump has sharply criticized these, and he has acted most aggressively and assertively on the Clean Air Plan, on that part of Obama's legacy. But on the Dreamers, he has been extremely cautious.
Yes.
He has indeed invited the Congress to pass legislation.
He wants them to decide the issue, right?
That would legalize the status. And the Paris Accord we haven't withdrawn from yet. He has just said we would withdraw from it.
Right.
So there is nothing that has happened here so far that raises big questions about Trump's view of executive power as expressed by legal actions. Now, obviously, President Trump, when engaging or indulging, I should say, in his rhetoric, seems to have a very strong view of his power that would make one a little nervous if it were delivered on.
Right. Before we go back to Trump, I have a few questions about him in this moment. When did this growth of executive power begin? Why did it begin?
Some of it goes back to the 19th century. President Lincoln's Emancipation Declaration, after all, was executive action, right?
I forgot about that. That's a good
on a very big
that
issue.
That was a pretty big issue, yeah.
So it begins early. President Jackson invoked a lot of executive power. But I think for the modern era, it is probably Roosevelt with whom it begins.
Okay. So born of crises, is that?
Because of the economic crises,
right,
and what he had to do and what he thought he had to do. And then it came one thing after another, really, in the decades that followed Roosevelt. And every president engaged in considerable executive action, of course, in particular in the area of foreign policy and the war powers, right? These big abstractions, which in the Constitution are clearly shared between the Congress and the president. The president is the commander-in-chief, but the power to declare war or to begin a war, really, is in the hands of the Congress. Presidents, as well as Congresses, have more or less shifted this around over the last few decades to a presidential power that not only makes it clearly possible for him to repel sudden attacks on the United States, that I think has been there from the beginning.
Right.
But in effect makes it possible for him to take all kinds of other action. Of course, most of it is just the rhetoric, right? If you if you say the wrong thing, if you behave undiplomatically with respect to a foreign country, you can create a crisis. And that President Trump seems to have been very little aware of.
Well, that's for sure. But in the balance of power between the executive and the Congress, and including in foreign policy, so if one is rising, the other one's getting weaker, is part of the problem that the Congress doesn't want to play this role, or they're just giving this power away?
I think the Congress doesn't want to play the role to a very large extent. All the tough decisions are being pushed either to the executive branch or in vague legislation to the courts that then have to interpret the legislation that takes no clear positions on matters. So I think to a large extent it is the fact that Congress does not take its oversight role, does not take its directing role very seriously. That also has been going on for a long time. Now, what is different, perhaps different now, is the fact that our political parties that obviously make up the Congress, the two parties, our political parties that have always been weak by comparison, let's say, with European parties,
right,
always seem to have been somewhat rudderless, no direct leadership. You never could identify other than a president of the congressional
who's
party.
Who's the party leader?
Who's the party leader?
Americans couldn't name them now.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that has gotten somewhat worse,
right,
in part because due to our primary system, President Trump managed to actually take over the Republican Party, though he was not even a Republican until recently.
Right.
And
Bernie Sanders made a pretty big challenge as I don't even think he is today even registered as a Democrat.
Yes. Right, right. And
the primary system allows that to happen? Is that
the primary system allows that to happen. If I were the czar and could change anything at all, and this is, of course, not a constitutional matter. This is either legislation, state legislation, legislation, or it is the rules of the political parties.
Parties themselves.
Themselves. Right. And to a very small extent, the Supreme Court has played some role here. But the primary system, combined with the first past the post rule.
Explain that just a little bit.
Meaning simply, if you have five candidates, the candidate gets nominated as a candidate of his party or her party, who gets the most votes. That can be 23% of the vote.
Right.
And if the others are pretty distributed. The combination of first past the post with primary elections that in many states are so-called open primaries, meaning you can on the day of election decide in which party you want to vote. You can vote only in one or the other. But you can be a Democrat who goes to the his polling place and says, oh, today I will vote Republican,
right,
the Republican Party. That is also a weakness. The parties have been weakened to some extent by this movement towards open primaries, meaning towards more democracy.
Right.
And what is misunderstood there, I think, is really parties are associations and need an effective associational structure and autonomy. And we have to a large extent undermined the little that strength there was to begin with.
Even before. And you mentioned in Europe, and especially continental Europe, much stronger parties because they have a different electoral systems, right? And different primary systems?
Yes. Primaries play some role, but really a
pretty
very, very
marginal.
Minor role. I think the more significant aspect is that take the German Christian Democrats and Angela Merkel, for instance. Well, she is the head of the party. And therefore, you can assume that if the party does not throw her out of that position, she will also be the chancellor if her party gets the most votes, right? So you have a combination of party structure, which has opened up, in particular in France, they now have had introduced primaries to some extent. But you have parties that have an organizational cohesion, and you have membership. You can ask somebody, are you a social democrat? And he will say, yes, I'm a member. I pay my dues.
Right.
I remember when I started teaching at the University of Chicago and taught a seminar on political parties. I would ask the students in the seminar, tell me, what party are you a member of? And they would say, Democrat or Republican. And I'd say, how do you know? How can you demonstrate this to
no
me?
No party cards, right?
No. Nothing. Party cards and so on. That, I mean, the parties have become weaker in Europe as well. The membership has declined and so on. But still, there is a different organization. The Democrats, for instance, presently have simply no leader, given that they have not yet decided on who should be their next presidential candidate, right?
It's a very odd system. The more I haven't thought about that, but we don't know who the party leader is.
No.
Formally, there's somebody who runs the DNC, but
yes.
They're not the leader.
No, the Democratic National Committee clearly is not it.
Right. And that leads to, you hinted at it, but I want you to expand on it. That leads to more populist kind of candidates or charismatic leaders, or you used the word Caesarism, I know, in a piece not too long ago. Is that in part because of the weakening of the parties, or are there other factors?
No, I think that is due to the fact that we have gone to the popular election of presidents, right?
Okay.
I mean, with the Electoral College, we'll ignore that for the moment. Basically, the popular election of presidents. And I think that has been the element that has put an emphasis on charismatic leaders who can persuade large parts of the population that they should follow them. I think President Trump is an excellent example of that.
Right.
Clearly a charismatic leader.
That's what he knows how to do, right?
That's what he knows how to do. And many people just put their trust in him, right? And so this has been going on for a long time. When I talk about presidents being Caesarist, what I mean is that they use their power to the fullest. And basically, You can still believe in law. You don't have to be Nixon. Remember, Nixon said, when the president thinks something is legal, that means it is legal, right?
Yeah, I do remember that, yes.
And that is a position, by the way, President Trump has not yet taken.
So far, so good, yes. Let's talk about a third branch, the courts, in terms of checks and balances. How do you see that piece of our constitutional design working today?
Well, so far, I think the courts have indeed proven that they are a third branch, that they are somewhat independent. On the matter that received most attention in the courts, President Trump's effort by executive order to limit Muslim immigration or immigration from certain countries, the courts interfered very quickly, suspended the whole scheme. And I was actually surprised because whenever the president, and he has some powers under the relevant legislation and some powers as president under Article 2, whenever the president invokes national security,
right,
courts have often shown a lot of deference to the president. And in this case, they didn't.
They didn't.
Now, it is also clear that when we look at the judges who made these decisions, they were mostly, not only, but mostly Democrats who have been appointed by Democratic presidents, and which shows the problems we may face on the long run. That is, as a Republican president uses his power to nominate and make judicial appointments, and there are lots of vacancies
right now, right?
Right now, the character of the courts may change, probably never to the extent to which people kind of popularly assume so. The Supreme Court renders many decisions unanimously, and it is also clear in the lower courts and the courts of appeals and so on, where you can actually look for data, that the courts are much of the time are guided by non-political principles.
Well, that's an interesting dynamic. Again, I think a lot of people don't understand that members of courts do have a political affiliation, or not formally. How does that work exactly?
The way we distinguish between Democrats and Republicans on the courts is simply by looking to the president who appointed them, right?
Okay. All right.
Now, we have to also understand, however, that actually most federal judges at the level of district judges are chosen by the senator of the president's party.
As a practice.
Very widespread. That was also the case for the courts of appeals until President Carter and subsequent presidents began to change that. But even now, though the choice of federal appellate judges is with the president, the fact is he will consult, of course, the senators of his party from the state where a vacancy occurs.
I see. My last question is about not the institutions in the Constitution, but the citizens. How do you think they're doing? Are they performing the role that they're supposed to in a democratic society, or have we gotten lazy, or what's your kind of broad sweep take on citizenship?
Well, going back to the emails I received, many of them seem to be performing the role.
Okay, well, that's good.
But having said that, look, Mike, our biggest problem is indeed the fact that the political discourse has become quite uncivil. And unfortunately, citizens engage in the same kind of discourse to a large extent that their political leaders engage in.
Right.
Judging by the emails I get, which ask me to join this or that cause, the language that is used often is pretty vile, I have to say.
Right.
The antagonistic way of conducting politics, that is one of the reasons Congress has become so ineffective, is something you unfortunately also find among citizens. So my urging would at all times be to anybody who wants to be a good citizen, think about the language you're using as you try to persuade somebody else or as you try to oppose somebody.
Right. And is there a role that Stanford University could be playing in that?
only in living the civil discourse that a university should more than any other institution follow. You should never kind of take the position in a university that somebody's views should not be taken seriously because of gender, race, or whatever it may be. And I think in a university it is at all times appropriate to be civil, even to be humble at times.
Oh, that's an interesting word. Humble.
Humble. We have all, it's all based on the notion that we indeed in universities are always trying to, ourselves trying to permit for the fact that what we are saying may be wrong and maybe not be the truth.
That's some great advice for us all, including us professors. Gerhard, thank you for joining us. You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford or visit our website at fsi.stanford.edu for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.